But tonight, I'm very happy. I'm absolutely delighted to have one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, Rob Schmidt, who is also a meditation teacher at the Taiyu Center, which is the owner of the store. He's been a practitioner in the Taiyu tradition for 30 years, 35 years?
Over 30 years.
Over 30 years. So, he's a good friend and a wonderful business partner and insightful, and his many years of meditation shine through. And so today he will be giving a talk called The Bitter Roots of Ecstasy. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you. Well, ecstasy, where to start? Such a big topic, we'd like to think. How many of us have had an ecstatic experience in this room, would you say? Okay. Fairly high. Excellent. Excellent. Just in case they didn't pick up on the mics, there was a member of the audience who said she is having an ecstatic experience at this very moment. I'm delighted to report for the audience who will download the MP3 file of this talk at some future time from the web, from our website. Okay, so I hardly need talk much about what an ecstatic experience would be for most of you, but some of you who didn't raise your hands, maybe you were being modest, or maybe you're not sure what an ecstatic experience would be. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing, because ecstasy is something that is usually talked about in very restricted contexts in our culture. And spiritual practice, or being a product of spiritual practice, is certainly one of those contexts. Another context is interpersonal communion, often of a physical nature. People refer to the ecstasy that can arise in that sort of context when the usual barriers between people disappear. So there are several contexts in which what we might call ecstasy can emerge. But what I want to suggest for you for your consideration tonight is that the kind of ecstasy that I find interesting and want to talk about in particular is the ecstasy that is not simply the product of random generosity by the universe, but is actually the product of cultivation of factors that elicit random generosity from the universe. In other words, it may well be that people have the experience of ecstasy, whatever that means to each individual person, at particular times and places as a result of a karmic debt owed to one. And that's fine. It shows what is possible to achieve. And there might be other reasons, environmental reasons, if you will, circumstantial reasons, why an ecstatic experience might emerge. But it seems to me that one of the promises of spiritual practice is and ought to be the cultivation of factors that will allow for the emergence of ecstasy at will, at need, when it is appropriate to do that. So, one of the things that's my privilege as one of the owners and operators of this institution, Many Rivers Books and Tea, is to be present for a number of spiritual talks by people from lots of different spiritual traditions. And one of the things that's been very common in the store lately, over the last years, is to hear people talk about how liberation is achieved. And there is a certain strain of, or a certain set of views about this that I'm going to comment on and reflect off of. And that is the view that basically all we have to do is change our ideas about who we are, surrender our ideas about who we are, and all will be bliss. That it's only our ideas about who we are that keep us immured in a cesspool.
Sucking quagmire.
Sucking quagmire is the word, is indeed, I think, the phrase that I used in the write-up for this talk. And that is a view with which I am in profound disagreement for the following reasons. Ecstasy is a gift that touches the entirety of the organism and more. What do I mean by the organism? In our tradition, the organism is composed of the body, the heart, and the mind. And the body, the heart, and the mind are simplifications for the functioning of this physical creation as it exists in this material realm. But I'm offering for your consideration, please don't take my word for it. Please always check everything I say in your own experience, against your own experience, and be willing to do experiments to see whether what I have to say makes any sense, or what anyone has to say makes any sense. So, I'm suggesting that the arising of ecstasy needs to touch more than just the mind. The arising of ecstasy needs to emerge from the lived experience of being in a body. And the lived experience of being in a body is not something that we should take for granted. We think we experience these bodies. We go around and we, you know, we stumble on the sidewalk and maybe scratch our, you know, shins. We have various aches and pains. These bodies undergo various different transformations over time. But I'm suggesting for your consideration that, in fact, we don't really know our bodies. Moreover, I'm further suggesting that we don't know our hearts either, for the most part. We don't know our bodies for the most part. We don't know our hearts for the most part. And by heart, what I mean is the reverberations in the body that are the product of ideas about relationship. These are the emotional reverberations that ping back and forth in the organism from the mind into the body, and that we are in the habit of interpreting as emotional reactivity: anger, jealousy, fear, pleasure, all these sorts of things. These are another class of functioning of the organism. And then there's the intellectual realm, the realm of mind, where in addition to imagination, which is the purest form of the intellectual realm, what we have the greatest amount of experience with is actually something that in our tradition we call the operation of the android, which is our term for ego. And by that I mean the voices in your head that tell you what to do and how things are, moment by moment. Your mommy's voice telling you to look both ways before you cross the street. your friend's voice daring you to be a naughty girl or boy when you were a kid, the variety of voices that we hear in our heads. These are artifacts of the mind that are the product of our interaction with human society. And that is the realm where we tend to get stuck as a result of our presence with these other organisms running around that look more or less like our organisms, and that we have a set of relationships to. In fact, it's more complicated than that, because we're primate mammal mammalian organisms, and primate mammalian organisms actually are constituted through social interaction. In fact, we learn how to operate our physical bodies as a result of proximity to our mothers and other caregivers as we grow up. People who are isolated from contact with other bodies, physical bodies, even in adulthood, are less healthy than those who tend to have regular contact with other human bodies. Plenty of studies to support this stuff. So it's a very complicated mix of things. And this is the matrix within which spiritual practice is supposed to emerge, or from which spiritual practices must emerge, because that's the matrix that we find ourselves in. So how can ecstasy, which is an evocation of limitless, free communion with the universe, how can ecstasy arise in a context where our interactions are governed by mechanical reactivities that arise in ourselves to the actions, statements of others? How can they arise when our bodies seem to themselves be impediments in our usual way of looking at them to the arising of ecstasy? Come on in, have a seat. There's one right there. So it's a problem. And what I'm suggesting for your consideration in reaction to some of the other speakers we've had in our store is that it's a much more difficult problem than simply changing your mind about who you are, what you're doing, and why you're doing it. It's a matter of seeing who you are, what you're doing, and why you're doing what you're doing, which is not a very flattering picture all too often. And so we tend to look away from that unpleasant view, the prospect even of that unpleasant view, and find all kinds of ways to distract ourselves with ideas about how we might be able to emerge from this this set of networks that seem to act as chains and not as nurturing sources of nutrition for something which might touch more than just this organism. So that's another aspect of the problem, is where do we find the connection? If ecstasy is, as I've said, something that is an avenue for communion at a level that involves the entirety of the organism and more, what's that more? What is that more consist of. This might be a good place to stop for see if there's any questions, comments at this point. Thank you. Tea lubricates. Yes?
Yes, in the topic of ecstasy, mm-hmm. why is it that we communicate amongst ourselves that the symbols become the form of communication, not the actual description? Like if I go into a casino and I bet a coin and I win two, I win another two, but I let them all store up inside the slot machine. And then at a certain time, I press the cash out button, and a whole bunch of coins drop out. Maybe 100, 200 coins will drop out all at once. This is like a very vaulting experience, like the one that Tolle talks about that he had, and Lee Lazarus talked about. So, you know, these really intense experiences. Mm-hmm. Ecstasy. But then the symbol also can be used for another kind of ecstasy, a mini one, where there are people, if you notice at the casinos, they'll bet a coin and they'll win two coins and they cash out the two coins, so ding ding, and they put it in, they win two more and they cash out, ding ding. So there's these little insights into something, but it's not vaulting, but it's an effort towards liberation.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many ones.
Right.
And so my question is, that in mind, is that I think these big experiences, there's some kind of compression, I feel, that we create in ourselves. And at a point, we can't hold on to it anymore, and it just releases. And this is the state. And through symbols from other people and through teachers and education and meditation, you learn to cash out sooner rather than have, you know what I'm saying, than these things, and you can view them better. You can evolve better. But my question is that example I just gave, there's a certain understanding that we all have with the symbol. But if I explain my exact experience and everything, it wouldn't make any sense. And I noticed that when I talk with other people or if I read, the symbols are more powerful than our dialogue. And there's people that do not grasp symbols. You know, they haven't entered that world.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't entered the casino. They're elsewhere. And so the symbols don't mean anything, except for minor ones like but you know, cross and star David and very universal kind of things. But these other symbols, and especially in language, where ordinary language all of a sudden transforms into a communication through symbols.
Mm-hmm.
And why is this not only universal, but is something that we actually cherish if we can experience that? Do you have any? Could you add anything to that?
Well, I'm going to take it a little bit in a slightly different direction from what you've given me. Hopefully, this will be at least an interesting response. We'll see. But basically, I'm going to make the observation that there are ways to experience life that are immured in the ordinary experience of life. And my own view is that the symbolic realm is in fact one of those realms. The symbolic realm does not take us beyond the ordinary experience of life. It is often a more elevated, in some ways, energetic place. But it is not in itself the place of ecstatic communion that I'm trying to get at in this talk. So when you go to a talk with a spiritual teacher, what is often happening without the mind being aware of it is that an exchange of energy is beginning to ring so that we can all hear it.
This is a non-aesthetic experience.
What's that?
I like spoken word with music. Mm-hmm.
I like spoken word with music as well. In fact, that's one of the things that is one of the more powerful aspects of the symbolic realm that we're just speaking about, because when the spoken word, which in lyrical form, in the form of lyrics to a song, is essentially a form of poetry, and it is linked to this other part of the mind that pulls in the musical appreciation aspect, then that in fact is a very powerful evocation of something that takes us often out of our ordinary experience of life, which tends to be for most of us pretty humdrum, pretty mechanical, pretty solidly reactive in various ways. Even when we don't see we're being reactive, often that's exactly what's happening. That's the sort of basic thesis that most or many spiritual traditions will use to describe usual pedestrian human experience. But that in itself still doesn't get us symbol plus music or language plus music still doesn't get us to this ecstatic place. Yeah.
Okay. Well, to start out with, I was thinking the definition of ecstatic is outside the body.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I've heard people talk about, like my grandson was on a roller coaster and he told his mom he was really scared. He felt like he was out of his body.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, that's what drug addicts talk about, in their experience.
Right,
and, sometimes people meditate and they, oh, I'm so high, I'm out of my body.
Yes.
But it sounds like the ecstatic communion you're talking about would be taking all the functioning, all the parts with you to this ecstatic moment.
That's exactly the thesis that I'm offering for your consideration. So let me flesh that out a little bit, because the point about being out of your body as being a high energetic place is the basis, I think, for so many both traditions and practitioners and teachers as well wanting to locate the place of ecstasy as being something that leaves the body behind, that is aside or apart from the body, beyond the body, etc. And I think that the experience of people who take drugs, who get high in other ways by doing challenging sports, for example, skydiving, or a less death-defying sort of sport. But nevertheless, the reason that people undertake these things, drugs and peak experiences, is precisely so that they can have the experience of being in the body with the usual apparatus of mind, the voices in our heads, shut down, because that is, in fact, a higher energetic place than the usual experience. Now, I also want to point out that the symbolic, that the engagement with the purely symbolic and the engagement of the symbolic with music and language, these are also higher energetic places than we usually occupy. These are more interesting places to hang out in general. But they still aren't going where I want to take this talk eventually, which you have just very nicely formulated it for me, actually. which is that when we leave the body behind, we are missing the point of having been incarnated in a body in the first place. We come to this realm, to these particular bodies, for very particular reasons, because there are particular notions, lessons, particular information that is necessary to imbibe, that is available only through the experience of these bodies. So what I'm suggesting is, in fact, that it is the full engagement with the experience of the body, as that body is the locus of the emotional reverberations I talked about and the intellectual capacities, both the less interesting ones from my perspective, that is the voices in our heads, as well as the imaginative capacity. The body is the locus of all of those. But if we send the imaginative capacity away from the body, we're losing something, is what I'm suggesting. And the product, the ecstatic communion product that I'm suggesting, we can learn to invoke deliberately and even consistently, is a product that must arise from engagement with the body as the primary tool. Come on in. The body is the primary tool in the view that I'm offering for you for your consideration tonight. The body is the primary tool by which we do this work. So, why the bitter roots of ecstasy? That deliberately provocative title. The reason that people want to leave their bodies is because it's so damned uncomfortable. So often. It's no mystery. It's no secret. There's a lot of suffering involved with being in these bodies, with being identified with these bodies. And the mistake that is so natural to make, and so common, so commonly made even by very smart people, is the assumption that identification with the body in all its forms, all the forms of identification with the body as the organism that is the locus of these emotional identifications, these identifications with this body, the locus of identifications of the mental realm that this body supports, those can, or I should say, those are usually experienced in terms of slavery, in terms of I'm stuck and I can't get out. That's how it feels all too often when we are identified with various aspects of being in the organism. And so it's natural to think that, oh, all I have to do is get out of this thing in some way, shape, or form. Maybe it's meditation. Maybe I can meditate my way out of this body, and that'll make me feel happy, or that will relieve the suffering that is so apparently innate to the condition of this body. Well, what I'm suggesting further is that, in fact, the condition is just precisely the solution. We need to seek out the condition of suffering, to go towards the condition of suffering, to go towards the experience of being in these bodies and learn a subtle trick. And that subtle trick is to be in the body, but not of the body. To be fully engaged with what this organism is doing on all the levels that it can do it. And I'm talking about the highest intellectual realms, the most heart-open emotional realms, where we're talking about not just mechanical reactivities, but the actual emergence of love and compassion and the connection that the connectivity that, that arises from that, and even the level of physical connection. So all these aspects of the experience of these bodies are not just the problem, they're also potentially the solution. But the trouble is, it's not an easy thing. That, hence the title, The Bitter Roots of Ecstasy. When we were little kids, it became very clear for almost all of us that there were a variety of reasons to attempt to disconnect from our lived experience. Little kids are in their bodies. I mean, infants and small children just acquiring language. They're in their bodies. They don't have the capacity to get out of their bodies for the most part. And you see what that experience is like. They are subject to the conditions that they find themselves in. If someone smiles, they smile back. If someone frowns at them, they feel bad. If they're hungry, they're unhappy. If they've just had some delicious, or in the process, more precisely, in the process of eating something that they like, they're happy. It's very simple. We're actually like that too, but we mask that, of course, in so many ways. But the potential of spiritual practice is to return to the body that we knew as infants, as small children. Except that we do it no longer blindly innocent and thus easily hurt, but we can bring with us information about how the universe works that we've acquired during the process of adult life. But we can only do that if we do it with the right sort of methodologies. And the right methodologies are not obvious. They are not straightforward. They are not contrary to what you would think by looking at all the books here on this on the shelves in our store, which is devoted to cultivation of this. It's not straightforward, even though many of the books eloquently speak of this process. But we need to speak to the parts of ourselves that the mind doesn't access readily. And that's why we have techniques like meditation to address that sort of thing. Techniques that engage the body in cultivation of awareness. So we want to put awareness upon, attention upon, all these different aspects of human existence. And as I said, those are the sucking quagmire that we so assiduously seek to avoid looking at so often in our lives. It's not that actually it is a sucking quagmire. It's that we have the idea that it's a sucking quagmire. I mean, sure, it's highly unpleasant, but the actual experience of being present to suffering, the actual experience of moving towards suffering, as opposed to compulsively running away from suffering, usually isn't quite as bad as people project their minds. That's part of the solution. Yeah.
I have my own take on this, and I'm glad to see what you think. I think that our basic organismic tendency is to recoil from pain because pain is a warning sign of possible of an insult to the organism, which could cause damage and even threaten our survival. So, for instance, when you put your hand on a hot stove, you quickly take it away. A mother yanks her kid out of the street. That our basic bodily experience is one that pain warns us of danger to the organism. And so we're so kind of instinctually conditioned to react in that way towards pain. But there's a very important distinction that needs to be made, which is that pain whose cause, whose source is internal in terms of the story that we have about the events that are presenting themselves. Because most suffering is about the story that we tell ourselves about what's occurring, more so than what's actually occurring. It's how we're holding it. So if we could learn to make that distinction, that the kind of suffering that arises from our own, from the mess that we've taken in through bad experiences in life, through being inculcated with erroneous beliefs about ourselves, negative feelings, if that's the source of the suffering, then it's a completely different modus operandum that we have to adapt, which is what you are addressing, which is moving towards the suffering rather than running from it. Because only in moving towards it can we see what it is, where it came from, and begin to possibly undo it.
Got that?
Yeah.
Well, let me respond. I'm completely with you at the begin with the source that you're talking about in terms of these instinctual reactions to pain and suffering. That makes perfect sense to me, and I think is a nice summary of how that works. And I even agree to some extent with the view that a lot of the pain and suffering that we hold is the result of identifications that are located in narrative stories that we tell ourselves. But what I'm saying here is that it's way more than that, far more than that. The reactivity cannot be erased or eliminated or surrendered unless there is a moving towards the instinctive and reactivity of the organism, and maybe of more than the organism, that involves the body, involves the emotional reverberations and the mind, and that when we attempt to narrowly circumscribe it in the in terms of the ideas that we have about things, the stories that we tell ourselves about why things are so, then we only get a partial picture and an incomplete picture that will not actually alleviate the suffering and make possible the reaching through the suffering to this ecstatic communion that I was referring to earlier, which you may have missed because you came in a little late. But that's the thesis that I'm offering.
I didn't really get the mm-hmm. the distinction between what you're saying about the narrow.
It's more than the mind, basically. It's more than the mind. In other words, the source of suffering.
In our tissues.
It's embedded in many levels of compulsive reactivity. At many levels. And just changing the story we tell ourselves will only affect a small portion of what we need to do to no longer have to react compulsively and mechanically to products of the external and internal environment. The external and an internal environment might as well be the same, essentially.
If they trigger you.
Yes, if they trigger stuff, it doesn't really matter. And in fact, usually it's a combination. In fact, we have all these cascading reactivities happening all the time. It's like a pond where there are stones falling in that pond all the time, and reverberations moving through the organism, and one set of waves intersecting with another set of waves and creating a new wave going off in this direction, et cetera, et cetera. So we get this very complicated pattern. So what I'm arguing is that it's not what I'm offering for your consideration is that it is a far more profound form of internal examination that we need to do in order to see the bitter roots of our suffering and pain before we are going to be able to have some kind of quietude from which we can reach out to this
I think we're
this communion.
I didn't mean to suggest that it was anything less than profound.
Right.
The level of examination and
But it's not just the stories we tell. That's my distinction that I'm going to hold to here, mm-hmm. is that it is far more than that. It's sort of like here's this artifact here I'm going to hold up for the benefit of people not present here and listening to this on the MP3 that will eventually be on our website. This is something that most people would call a potted plant. And this potted plant has a reality, a symbolic reality, that partakes of its relationship to our ideas about plants, about pots, about where and how we put and place, how these things arise to be here, etc. But it is also an absolutely unique creation in and of itself, beyond words, that is constantly changing, constantly evolving, just like everything else. So, if it's constantly changing and constantly evolving, the symbolic representation of it cannot capture those qualities. But, I'm suggesting, there is a way for us to train ourselves to look at this beautiful being, this perfect creation, and see its nature without referencing any of that symbolic apparatus. Without referencing any of the intellectual apparatus, any of the apparatus of words. Even if I were talented enough to sing an aria to this potted plant. Obviously, I'm not talented enough. But if I were, even that would not encompass this incredible, perfect creation, which is perfectly changing as we sit here and speak. And I can look at each of you, as I have been doing this evening, and seeing the same quality in each of you. So that is something of what I'm talking about when I'm referencing this idea of ecstatic communion. So ecstatic communion is seeing reality without the
overlays.
The overlays, the apparatuses, and there are many, of the mind, the heart, and the body, even, that condition how we see reality. So when a child picks this thing up, the child can interact with it and touch it and move it around and look at it, maybe throw it on the floor and see what happens. All kinds of stuff a child might do.
So it's a sort of untainted perception, a pure perception that you're
hearing. It's a pure perception. And so I'm suggesting that ecstatic communion arises when we examine what it's like to be with the suffering inherent in these bodies and be absolutely present to that. When that is accomplished, then these beautiful things, all these beautiful things, become a part of oneself in a way that does not limit and is so far beyond our capacity to describe in words or to touch and communicate even through that modality, to sing about through that modality, to open our hearts even to.
Are you describing a state basically where we let go of all our resistance to what is?
That's one way to put it, but putting it that way is all too simple, because letting go of resistance is relatively easy when we can see the resistance. But when we have no experience seeing the resistance, that's the problem. So that's why, if you don't have communion with your own body, if you don't have familiarity with your own emotional mechanical habits, if you don't have familiarity with the mental shenanigans that your mind is constantly getting up to, at a level that is not another product of the mind, but that is aside from the mind and the ordinary experience of consciousness, then you're not going to be able to release what needs to be released, because these relaxations are not something that we can speak about them in this context, but it will only make sense to you to the extent that you've had some experience in being present to the clench that is preventing the release all along. So the body, the identification with the body, is a hugely important clench that we hold, and it has many, many, for most of us, it has many dimensions, many aspects. Yeah.
When you talk about being conscious or aware of the body, being able to know the body and all its pains, the only process I have with this is when I am quieter alone, and I can really slow my mind down enough, and I work with my breath to actually feel the reverberations in whatever part of my body is calling to me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any other way, for instance, walking down the street, being with other people, to have that conscious awareness and actually go to that space.
Mm-hmm.
While you're interacting with someone else and or trying to do a task, because my consciousness is very devoted to that particular moment of conversation and or tasking. Is there another way of allowing my consciousness to be in tune with my body to go to the necessary places to not only confront but to employ an invitation to walk inside those spots of pain while tasking and conversing?
Thank you. That was beautifully said, by the way. I really liked that. Yes, the answer is there are. In fact, there are two principal ones that I will mention. One is a process that in the Gurdjieffian tradition is called self-observation. And it is a process whereby one establishes a witness consciousness, an aspect, sort of like this. It's sort of like bicycle training wheels at first, for a long time, but nevertheless, it's a very useful tool, and it is a basically a meditation in action. It's a way to be present to what you're doing and have a witnessing, a pure, agendaless witnessing, present during the process of washing the dishes, driving the car, etc., etc. And then the trickier part is in interaction with other people, and that's the second thing, and that's something related to the self-observation witnessing, which we call co-meditation. A co-meditation is a two-person meditation form that we use, where people establish and maintain eye contact, and in the basic form they simply put attention on the other person without agenda as best as possible. But there are many, many, many elaborations of that form where one person acts as the witness for the other person who is invited to explore aspects of relationship and talk about them in such a way as to systematically go through the contents of consciousness as we've created them with relation to relationship, and then have that experience both of having been witnessed and being able to witness another person without agenda as a part of daily experience.
So you're talking about two people having the practice and the willingness to be able to do that, mm-hmm. and education.
Yes.
In different interventions.
That is correct.
But I'm talking about, and I love that, this feeling that I have between, I don't know if you're familiar with Rumi and Shams.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in a relationship. I always felt it was not written. It was implied through Rumi's writings that this is the kind of relationship they had, and it escalated their awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, what I'm talking about is when I'm meeting a friend who's not in common with what we're speaking right now, and we're just talking about everyday things, and what I try to do is employ my witness consciousness at that time. And I'm good up to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
Then my ego starts dropping in, and then my witness says, here you go again, and then I just give in to my ego because it's necessary to carry on the conversation other than the kind of conversation we're having now. If I'm talking about his family, his sports, if he's asking me a question about what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
It seems to me that my witness consciousness can no longer be present, and I have to give in to the other part, even though my witness consciousness visibility is still there, but not as potent. So I can go into those conversations wonderfully, and then all of a sudden I get wrapped into them.
Got that. Well, I think it's a really important and good question. And my response is that basically, like any other form of meditation, bringing the witness consciousness, which does not speak, by the way, the witness consciousness does not speak. If it speaks, it's another part of the mental apparatus that needs to be observed in this process of witnessing. But it's just like anything else. When you practice something, you get better at it. And the reason that we do, the co-meditation form that we do, for example, in all the elaborate ways that the Tiger practitioners do them, is precisely to practice, to get experience of being present with as many different kinds of people, number one, as possible. So it should be possible to do this kind of witness consciousness with complete strangers, number one. Number two, it should be possible to do it with family members who know every button that you've got and are happy to push them at at every opportunity. It should be possible to do this when you've got enough experience with God. Okay? So none of these things, are, there's no secret in one sense, except, you know, it's very easy for us to convince ourselves that we've got a reliable witness, except those reliable witnesses do tend to start speaking. And when they tend to start speaking, that's when we have to employ the technique of stepping back, as it were, and witnessing that manifestation as well. And that's what practice gives you. Practice gives you the facility to do that better and better and better. So, to bring it back to the context, you know, that we've been talking about here, we need to be able to observe all the manifestations of the body without criticism, without evaluation, without identification as, oh, that's good or that's bad, that's pleasurable, that's not pleasurable. I mean, those things are going to arise, probably. Oh, that feels good. Oh, that hurts me. But we want to be able to witness both the phenomenon of the sensation as well as the phenomenon of the reactivity with complete clarity, without any agenda to have to change it from this witness that has that capacity. The rest of our consciousness doesn't have that capacity. It's not built to have that capacity. We can impose it occasionally, momentarily, or suppress the capacity to discriminate and make judgments, but that's not agendaless witnessing. That's not clarity. The clarity that is the foundation for the emergence of ecstasy is being present to the bitter truths, the often bitter truths, not always, but often bitter truths about our makeup and all the things that we have resisted looking at for so long. for so long.
It seems like the non-judgmental quality of the witness would help you to see these things about yourself. It's kind of like as if you could give that part of yourself more weight, it would help you to look at these things.
Precisely. That is putting it very, very, very concisely, I think. And in fact, the way that it's usually described in a number of traditions. The fourth way tradition has the idea of impression food. Every experience that we have is food for the organism. Every impression is food for the organism. The question is, where does that food go? What part of the being or organism does that food go to? So if it goes to this witness, this silent witness part of consciousness, that adds weight, that adds gravity, that adds momentum or inertia to the creation of this habit by which we can be present even when someone's screaming in our faces or is, you know, alternatively, saying something incredibly complimentary. That, you know, when I was in high school, that there was an award ceremony, and it was one of the hardest things I'd ever done in my life to go up and accept an award because I couldn't stand all that positive attention. Mostly, in retrospect, I can say it's because I feared that people would see all the things about myself that I thought were true, which was that I was a piece of crap and it was all a lie, and the teacher was just being nice to me, he'd give me that award, and, you know, blah blah blah. They'd see all the truths that I was holding on to. But the impression food, when it goes to that part of consciousness, the discrimination part of consciousness, the good-bad part of consciousness, then that tendency is fed. Whereas when we can create this silent witness aspect of consciousness and bring it to bear more and more on a moment-by-moment basis, then something else can happen. And that something else takes time, takes cultivation. The silent witness, and that's why I was disagreeing with the idea that it's only about changing the story. Because the story is just the intellectual part of this thing. The silent witness is witnessing every aspect of the impression, including all the nonverbal aspects of everything that we do, feel, think, say, and maybe even sense with perceptions that exceed the capacities of these flesh and blood organisms. Maybe. I offer you that possibility. Yeah.
I have a few things that tie into from beginning to here. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'll be able to do that if I fill up in a few words. One is, it seems to me that there is a particular belief that this isn't, I'm not in any way arguing against the concept that the story and changing thoughts is enough, mm-hmm. or not enough. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me there is a particular belief that ties into the whole picture, and that's the belief that we are somehow separate from the whole. And that is incorporated, I believe, as a fundamental concept out of which all the rest arises. Mm-hmm. And where it becomes very practical is in seeing that whereas all the other beliefs are something that the head is holding, as self-image, and then dealing with suffering on the inside of the body or trying to get out of it outside. Mm-hmm. It's because of some sense of identity with what's happening here behind the eyes and between the ears. Mm-hmm. Because out is always seems to go this way and in seems to go this way, and that's only the point of view of the head. Along with this, I'd say discerning between two different types of witnessing, so to speak, or observing. One, the witnessing of as mindfulness, in which the experience is known by the mind. But awareness is not a factor of mind, it's a capacity of consciousness, mm-hmm. which in my sense and understanding is something that is more housed in the body and the blood and being of who we are. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if mindfulness takes us so far in terms of dissociating or disidentifying with all these things, but then it's that move into awareness in which it's happening from the inside out as the only natural way it can take place without the mind just being in conflict between inside and outside, because it believes in some truth to inside and outside. Whereas consciousness, I don't believe, knows inside or outside.
Got that.
And out of that cannot possibly suffer. And any true experience of ecstasy is something that's released when the mind is no longer basically interfering with its own view of me and other than me, self or other than self. And it is rising from the inside out as the only way it can be total and complete.
Thank you. There's a lot in there to respond to, so I'll do my best to take up various different parts of that quite eloquently expressed view. So, first thing, I completely agree with the view that the belief in separateness is the fundamental illusion. But, and you were right to locate it as something more than just a product of the mind, in my view. But the problem with saying it is that most people won't relate to it, won't understand just how strong the habit of identification with the body really is. And that sense of identification with the body is the locus whereby so much of our difficulties arise. So the reason that I advocate using the body as the tool that we incarnated to have at our disposals is precisely because it's just the tool we need to examine. It's both the tool and the subject. But the operation of the body is where the way out lies, the way out of this problem of identification, of locating ourselves as separate from everything else. So, I mostly agree with what you had to say about attention, but I'm not sure that I would locate attention as being a function of the body, which I thought is what I heard you say,
no,
more or less.
Well, only in so much as the brain.
Okay. Then maybe we don't disagree on that. Actually, I would suggest that attention is actually something that is maybe not even a part of the corporeal universe, as we or material universe.
That's what I was using the word awareness.
Yeah. Right. Okay. There you go. So awareness, though, is not a product of the body, in my view, and so. It sounds like we're in agreement on that point. But what that means, practically, is because we find ourselves with these profound habits of identification, that we have to go to the source So when people seek to eject consciousness, attention, and awareness from the body, they're missing the point. That's my thesis here, and I think we're probably not disagreeing at all based on what you said.
No, I wasn't presenting that as a disagreement.
Right.
It was actually to tie in some language and the discernment between two different functions. One is of the brain, which is placing attention somewhere and directing mm-hmm. that.
Right.
And the other is a field of awareness, which has nothing whatsoever to do with the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on a practical level, if one instead, and I'm not saying this is any kind of truth, but if one instead associated it with the blood of our being, which permeates every cell of the body, and which is always most dense around the heart, which is one of the reasons why the word heart ever comes into this, but is more just as a place where the greatest amount of blood happens to be, that when we are in total presence, and it does, without any question about it, tingle from the inside out, from so-called heart out, but is of every cell of the body at the same time, then it can be a useful idea, not just to go around and challenging and changing other ideas, false ideas, but it can at least help direct the attention in the right place for that liberating quality of allowing things to be, just being totally present.
I got it. Thank you. That's clearly stated, I don't have a problem with that in one sense. I'll just mention that at one point I wrote an essay called Against Belief, and it was an attempt to talk about some of the things that we're talking about here right now. But the pervasiveness of the habit of belief makes me want to reserve just a little bit from going along with everything that you're saying in terms of, I understand that as an alternative way to look at our problem. I have absolutely no problem with what you said. In fact, I think it's very lovely and helpful. But there's actually no formulation that I want to invest final I always want to be able to put down a tool. That's kind of my bottom line. And in fact, I happen to think that because the universe is constantly changing, that's the only attitude that makes sense. So as lovely as that formulation is, even that one I want to be able to put down. That's the only reservation I have, basically, with what you just said. Yeah.
I wanted to add this last exchange called up for me the notion that it's very common for us to sort of point to the illusion of separateness as the sort of source of our problems. But isn't the illusion of non-separateness as much an illusion as the illusion of separateness? And in that sense, you know, there's this tendency to cling on to this one idea that we're not separate.
Right.
And that tends to lead to this impersonal place, whereas my own experience of the ecstasy is rooted very firmly in something incredibly personal. So I wanted to just ask you to speak a little bit on the relationship of the personal, whatever that means, to ecstasy.
Thank you. It's a good question, and it brings me to actually the a word that. It seems to me is very important to this discussion, and that is that when we are doing the work of self-examination, of being present of having a witness consciousness present to everything that's going on in the body, in the emotions, in the head, then what often arises on a personal level is an experience of what is often called poignancy. That is to say, that there is a poignancy about this plant in this pot at this moment. It is absolutely unique, precious, and this moment of the existence of the process of this potted plant will never be repeated, ever. Ever. So when we look at phenomena from that place with the tool of full attention upon and through the body, heart, and mind, then as you say in your comment, it's not a matter of some kind of impersonal presence outside this realm. It's being more alive. It's being more aware of our true condition than we could possibly be without those tools, without the possibility of looking at those tools. When someone you love dies, you can't usually help avoid that poignancy. I mean, people do by identifying with reactivities, with a variety of mechanical manifestations in the emotional, physical, and intellectual realms. But it's really hard to fully miss the poignancy that is so personal. That poignancy is what is the stepping off point for the ecstasy. Yeah.
Those tools more or less become our own personal dogma at a stage in time that really serves as an obstacle instead of getting us through to the actual poignancy of that moment of that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Again,
our own personal baggage, if we decide to go into using consciously the rationalization behind the tools. The tools themselves come out of that.
That's right. That's right. So the question always comes back to identification. It's not that we can expect that, you know, we're going to put aside the bitter roots. The bitter roots are going to be there. That's what creates the tension with the ecstasy. We need to encompass all of it together. That's where the poignancy emerges, and that's where the full engagement with being in a body comes from. It's an incredibly poignant thing to be alive. And often people appreciate that most in the moments before death. Not always, but the best deaths, and I've seen some pretty good ones, have that quality to them. They have that openness to the beautiful poignancy of I'm alive, but this is changing. This is going. This is always changing, always going. It's not just the illusion of separateness. It's the illusion that there's some kind of stability I can hang on to. Holy crap. What am I going to do when I realize that there's no place, no thing that I can find safety in, find refuge in, except the strategy of openness, the strategy of recognizing my interconnectedness. That's the only thing that's going to work. But it can only work at the level I'm talking about when you come to it through intimate engagement with the full experience of life. The full experience of life. Yeah.
Yes, questions on Peter Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Our mechanical understanding of ecstasy is always something fantastic. You know, the great arising, something fabulous.
You look marvelous.
Yes. Just everything. The whole world view is right there and beyond. How do you feel about the ecstasy being the dark side of ecstasy, of remorse of conscience, where, let's say, King David is one of the richest kings of man ever, and his son Solomon was also the seal of Solomon, and they had everything. And the spiritual insights they had and their knowledge by everyone and their accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, when King David had this intimate commune that you speak of, he said all his vanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that our efforts spiritually or to accomplish something is as if a pile of filthy rags in the corner somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It has, there's nothing. It's all vanity. Whatever you come up with. And that what you just said, he hints at that the intimate, what can we call it? Communion. That you have to be taken under the wings, so to speak, of something higher. You have to be in a state of ecstasy that might be composed of being broken and have contrary mind. You know, you think up is down. You know, mm-hmm. all views look the same.
Mm-hmm.
And and you've been defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And the average person on the street would say, "You're crazy. That's not ecstasy. That's so not. You are so out of it. That is not ecstasy." But what I'd like you to speak on would be how the intimate communion enters.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have a video I picked up. Three videos on the saints. And all of them, the stories are of people who have, these saints have experienced these states of ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in these other states other than this ecstasy. Of course.
Well, let me just respond to what you're saying, where I think you're going with this.
Basically, it is that I think our efforts are useless. And that's the bitter roots. And that the ecstasy comes from something higher than ourselves. Find some worth in something, anything. We scratch it on those certain way, and it just gives you what would be the spiritual path that would be above the ego attempts.
I got it.
Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying, and my point. That's fine. My point to respond to that is to focus on your use of you're basically talking about the phrase from Ecclesiastes: "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And what's vanity, of course, is all the attempts, all the ordinary attempts of all the aspects of the ordinary organism in the various forms of identification to do something about this issue. All of that is indeed vanity. I completely would go along with that. I do not agree with the view that everything has to be vanity, because there are ways that we can create conditions through the habits of creating through creating conscious habits, whereby we can invite the love of God, the divine blessing, into our lives in a consistent way. In other words, that stuff is always available. It's just that we're shutting it out all the time.
Exactly.
So the extent to which our efforts are not vain is precisely the extent to which we engage with the body, engage with the heart, engage with the mind, to see what the actual nature of these phenomena are, and hence to open ourselves to that ecstatic communion, which is far greater than anything this organism itself could produce through and with its own efforts solely. But if you're just waiting for lightning to strike, you may have a long wait. If, on the other hand, you learn how to create a lightning rod and go to the top of the mountain and look in the weather report and see when there's going to be a storm coming, then your chances of getting a strike increase dramatically. So that's the extent to which I would disagree with, or the extent to which I would agree and disagree with what you just said. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I totally agree with what you're saying, but sometimes it's seeing that all your attempts have been whims and nothing. Mm-hmm. The experience of really seeing that brings
yes.
you into touch with something higher.
Absolutely. And that's why being present to the fact of vanity is vanity of vanities, all is vanity, is the moment when a breakthrough can occur. I completely,
yeah.
I have seen that.
It's a question of how directly we can make efforts to have this happen. To me, it seems like you it's important to make efforts, but it isn't always your direct effort that gives, like, you do A, B, C, and you get the result of D.
That is true.
It comes in another way than
yes. Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I will say that when you make the effort to hold, in the Gurdjieffian terminology, it's holding yes and no together at the same time inside yourself. That is to say, that you can, and you can only do this, in my view, by creating a spacious witness that can allow that to happen.
Yeah.
So when you fully see, holy crap, I don't have a chance, I don't have a chance, then that's when the strike happens.
But it's like, can you create this space that holds the yes and no? Or who is the person who is creating this?
Mm-hmm.
See, I think it's...
That's the witness. The witness which does not have an agenda. If you're doing the project as effectively as you can over consistently over an amount of time.
I guess I just object a little bit to the idea that you're creating this.
Okay.
Because I think it is created.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I don't want to identify with the effort that creates it.
Well,
the word is arises.
Yeah, or something allows, or because it isn't. When I say I usually think of my conscious mind, you know, trying
mm-hmm.
to do this or that,
got
and it really arises more from some other totality that I don't have the kind of precise control over that I do feel that I do with my mind,
got
which
it.
I may not.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
That's clear. Yeah, I think you were next.
Yeah. What seems to work to me is a forbearance, the willingness to experience whatever I'm feeling right now, whatever I'm going through. Mm-hmm. That totally takes up my attention. And there's no all the mechanics of dreaming or imagination or the shortcuts or intellectually, that all goes. It's almost like being blind. It's a very limited way of doing, but it changes things.
Got that. Thank you.
And directing us towards the characteristics of the witness consciousness, what I experience in witness consciousness, and I would like for you to add more characteristics of your experience of it,
mm-hmm.
Is sort of a weightlessness and no contraction, no thought process, no demand through a thought process, mm-hmm. adding to the weightlessness of it, and it's an observance state that seems to kind of have a direction, but the direction is kind of floating, but it's very perceptive.
Okay, I'm not quite clear what that's all about. What the last part's about. I was with you for the first part, but in terms of direction, that's what I'm not quite clear about.
The direction would be where whatever I'm witnessing at the time, there's a direction in that. If I'm witnessing a conversation that I'm a part of, then there is a direction towards that conversation.
Okay. I got that.
That I'm aware of what I'm saying, I'm aware of the other person's saying, and I'm taking in as well as putting out.
Okay. Well, my response is that there's a way for the witness to be completely present but not engaged with. In other words, there's a phrase that was sometimes used by my teacher's teacher, and it was fair witness. A fair witness is one that is present to a process, but is not engaged in it. Isn't even necessarily a catalytic element, but is simply present with that. Does that? I don't know if that clarifies it.
It does. That adds to what my perception of it would be, which, yes, it does add to it. I guess I'm looking for something else as well. Maybe that would be a level that I haven't experienced that would come away from any frustration. There's no frustration within mm-hmm. the witness state. Right. As a characteristic of it, it's palpable within it.
Right.
Is there anything else that's palpable besides like a weightlessness or no frustration?
Actually, it's the witness that I was trained to create and have relied upon for these many decades does not speak, has no agenda, has no function other than to be present. But it's certainly gotten more spacious over time,
right.
More able to hold stuff than it used to be. So, but that's the I interpret that as being the product of continuing cultivation.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Thank you.
Well, I think a factor in what he's saying here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Frustration can't arise without there being an effort that's being frustrated. And a lot of it, I think, comes back to, is this the product of a desiring mind so mm-hmm. that I experience ecstasy, or I experience presence, or I experience this or that,
mm-hmm.
or I am the witness, or can it be more effortless, or finding that in the material world, right effort may be to try harder, but in the immaterial mm-hmm. world, the spiritual world, is to try softer. And
I like that phrase.
Well, it puts you back in the present.
Or it can, anyway.
Well, it's in the direction of releasing rather than grasping for.
Right. Got it. Thank you. Well, I mean, one of the things that I think it's probably time to conclude, but and I thank you for that comment, because it gives me it reminds me of something that I can say to conclude, which is that we actually have a workshop coming up this Saturday for those who are interested. In we'll be doing our co-meditation techniques at our house, Taiyu House, about 3 miles outside of town here. So if you're interested, you can ask Stuart or Amba here about that. We also have ongoing meetings, which happen every Tuesday except the fourth Tuesday, and the next Tuesday happens to be a fourth Tuesday here in this space. That's our Soul of Presence group meeting. So that's another thing to look at if you want to know more about this stuff, at least how we do it. We definitely don't claim to be the only source. That, in my view, is one of the more pernicious beliefs that gets pervade. But we do think that for some people it's useful stuff. So so that's some of that's it's from 10 to 5 on Saturday, and there's a variety of other things that we do as well, but those are the most obvious public events. Stuart's going to be giving another talk here, a gentleman over there, in the middle of July. I'm forgetting. I think it's the 23rd of July, here in this space again. And so I think that's it. I think I will just conclude by thanking you all for coming out and engaging in with some really good heartfelt responses tonight. Thank you.